Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
Coming up on episode 286 of Wheel Bearings, we do some driving on ice and snow with Infiniti vehicles on Bridgestone winter tires. Nicole drives the Jeep Grand Wagoneer L Obsidian. Sam gets the Nissan Pathfinder Platinum. Tesla has to recall some of its FSD software. Ford has problems with lightning batteries. There's a fix for the Hyundai and Kia theft problems. And where should the charging ports go? All that and more coming up next. This is episode 286 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abul Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin, and this week I'll be from Forbes.
And I am Roberto Baldwin. I'm going to say I'm from the Wall Street Journal's Buy Side.
Ooh, fancy. Ooh.
Yeah, I'm a day late on my article, but I'm there.
they don't need to know that. Don't tell people that.
Don't tell people you're late.
What is Buy Side? Is that a special?
It's like Wirecutter. Wirecutter. I'm doing e-bikes for them.
Oh, excellent.
Ride e-bikes? Guy?
I have an e-bike article going up on USA Today's Reviewed.com at some point. Ooh. And then I have this other one going up. And I really like the e-bikes because you can kind of just do these short little trips around your house. And, you know, I'm sort of out of shape.
You could get an e-bike and ride that up to Napa and back.
Yeah, I probably
just, well, let me just put that in the back of the Hummer.
There's one of
and
them that
you
I could.
To the hotel, you can ride that home and then ride it back the next morning.
When I was supposed to pick up a Rivian once from one of the little showrooms that they have. And they're like, oh, it's here. Can you make it there? And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, oh, I have an e-bike. I'll take an e-bike to BART. I'll take BART down to, I think it was in South City. And then I'll get off, and then I'll just ride the e-bike, and I'll throw the e-bike in the back of the Rivian, and then I'll drive it home. And they're like, oh, no. We'll just bring it to you. I was like, no, it's perfect. It's like,
because I need to put some miles on the bike anyway.
Yeah, you're putting like, oh, I put 50 miles on the bike, which doesn't seem like a lot when you drive cars all the time, but
it's a lot when you're on a little bike.
But it's an e-bike, you know, it can go farther than that on electricity. So
yeah, it's about 30 most typically they're about 30 miles 25 30 miles yeah. for the e-bikes. We live in a very hilly area, and I'm heavier than I don't know if I'm heavier than most people, but
you're tall.
I am tall, so I'm
you're
just
tall.
Like
it's all that height. Those large, broad shoulders.
Yeah, it's
long bones and everything.
Look how long this arm is. Just one arm.
Imagine if you added both in there. That's a lot of ass.
God, that's a lot of arm.
Wait. Oh, there's the other one. Anyway, e-bikes are great. You should cruising around.
Finally get a chance to try a couple of e-bikes one in November when I was at the Electrify Expo in Austin.
How'd that go?
I had never ridden an e-bike before, and I tried three different ones, and it's pretty cool. If they weren't so darned expensive, I would consider getting
one. How much does an e-bike, now that you're the expert, Robbie, how much do they typically run?
15, like a good, like you can just get a good one for like 15 to 2500, which is, you know, but when you, which you're like, wow, that's expensive. But have you priced out bicycles recently?
That's a good point. The ones that I had a chance to try were more like, you know, $4,000 to $6,000.
Yeah. It's just,
What made them worth more? Why are they fancier? Like, why are they that much more?
No idea.
Sam's like, I don't know. About these.
It's accessories, the builder, you know, how it's being propelled. I mean, a lot of them you use a hub on the back, which is less expensive, but there's like a mid-drive system where the power is actually coming from the cranks, you know, the things you pedal.
Yes.
And those are typically a little bit more expensive, but they're a lot better because that's, you know, it's...
Okay.
It's like putting... trying to think of the best way to it doesn't anyway that's why they're more expensive. You can go and look up e-bikes, and I'll have an article.
I'm gonna have to read your article and make one of it. Now I'm curious. Buy
Side and I don't know how long it takes. If it's like Wirecutter, it'll take a few weeks before of edits before it goes live, which I'm totally fine with.
As long as you get paid.
As long as I get paid. No, the very nice folks over at Bysider, they're very nice to me. I don't know why people are nice to me, but they are.
Because they, once they get to know you, you know,
they're afraid I'm going to get them with my long arm. I'm just going to reach out and grab them. Hold on.
All right. What have you been driving with more than two wheels?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I was going to talk about the EV6 GT, but I haven't done all the calculations. There's a lot of math for this article that I'm writing. So I haven't done the calculations yet because I went to Montana and I saw somebody there. A fine gentleman by the name of Sam, but I drove.
Wow, there's somebody by the name of Sam who's a fine gentleman. I can't imagine that.
Well, there's one in Montana because there's only like 12 people in Montana.
Yeah, that's true.
But apparently they're all super rich. I don't understand.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All I can think of now is I started watching Yellowstone.
Yellowstone.
And everybody in Montana is a gangster / horse wrangler. No,
they're all and I like to call him like Cowboy Batman because he has a Cowboy Batman voice, and now you'll never not hear that. Every time he talks, he's like, "I gotta save the ranch. My family fought for this ranch for hundreds of years."
Oh God damn it!
It's the same thing over.
He does sound like Cowboy Batman.
Sounds like Cowboy Batman.
All he needs is a cape. Or at least make that meme. You guys are savvy. Make up a thing of him and like Cowboy Batman, and just put a little cape on the back of
that Kevin Costner.
Little pointy, pointy ears on his hat.
And the first, we watched four seasons, and by the second or third season, I'm just sort of hate watching it because it's just like just ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, and I love it. I need to find season five.
Yeah, that's where we got to. Like, well, we could pay for it. Like, nah. We'll
I know. I can't. Even, like, that's where I'm like, okay, gotta pay for this. But then there's the prequels, and for those of you who are into cowboy stuff and Kevin Costner, watch Yellowstone.
But it's anyway. We're not a Yellowstone podcast. Not yet.
Could be. Okay, go ahead.
So I went to Montana.
Well, I can say I have not watched a single moment of that show, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay,
it's fine.
Cowboys, gangsters, okay. Shooting people.
It's weird. It's like Dallas for. Yeah, it's not good. It's just like, it's entertaining, sort of, sometimes, if not infuriating, at least. QX60, I drove the Infiniti QX60. I think we're going to talk about it, too. So we could just talk about that now if you want.
Yeah, let's do it now.
Let's do it right. now. Let's
so we're sort of Blizzak stands on this
We
this
absolutely
podcast.
Are. I believe we have mentioned specialized winter tires once or twice on the show before.
Yes. We kind of like Blizzaks. We kind of like winter tires.
So Sam and I were both on separate waves. We were in Montana, and we got to drive the new Infiniti QX60 on Blizzaks, on snow, on ice. Like ice you just can't stand on. You'll fall down because I almost fell down on it trying to put a GoPro on. And you know they were very they gave us a lot of leeway compared to some other ice driving programs I've been on. Some of them they're like there's someone in the car with you making sure you don't smash their car into the snowbank. Some of them they have someone on the radio like yelling at you. This one they were like okay go.
I love they'd be like we have someone to coach you and that coaching is slow down. It's like I feel like I'm being yelled at.
No, well, actually, you know what it is on the wave before I was there the day before you. The day before us, there was a wave of how shall I put this without being too condescending?
Lifestyle
people.
And
there was apparently one person there who had just got a driver's license like 2 months earlier.
Oof.
What?
Yeah, and had never driven on snow or ice, and on the ice slalom that he talked about. Apparently. On the second cone, went straight into the snowbank, and this was on the first pass through where we had to follow
the slow cone.
Yeah, follow the leader. Because on each of the exercises, on the first pass through, we followed one of their professional drivers through, so they could just show us which way we're supposed to go, and so on that. On that first pass, the lead and follow through the ice slalom, that this person went into the snowbank
Oh, Lord.
And was quickly followed by another lifestyle person who bounced off the back of their vehicle.
Oh my gosh! They hit each. They fit.
And then on my wave, the pro drivers that they had there, the leaders were so impressed by our level of skill with driving in snow and ice.
You've all had your license for more than, I don't know, six months.
What I'm really confused by, because I was invited to that program as well and couldn't make it, and I was really sad because I love ice. I love winter driving. Just let me slide around on the snow. I love it. It's so much fun. But they're picking, like, okay, we're going to invite this person and that person. This person writes for this outlet, and this person writes for that outlet. And let's invite Mike, who's had a driver's license for 2 weeks, to drive in the snow. Is that not something you vet at a time? I feel like that should have been something maybe someone should have
gone. I think so, but
I feel like a ball was dropped, and as a result,
I guess, did you know, like, how? I mean, without looking at the paperwork for cars that we've gotten, we get in. Do they know when we got our driver's license?
Well, but like, if
they know when it's expired.
Here's the thing: if you just got your driver's license 2 weeks ago, Robbie, nobody knows you because you haven't been doing this.
Come on, let's not exaggerate. It was 2 months ago.
If you just got your driver's license 2 months ago, nobody knows you because you haven't been doing this. So you're still a new kid on the block. So you'd assume because you're the new kid on the block, you've only been driving for 2 months. It's not like you have a wealth of driving history and reviews behind you. You're new. You have to know you're new because just appeared.
Yeah. You know, I do. I mean, I don't know specifically who was on that wave, but the impression that I got was it's people who aren't normally reviewing cars. It was, you know,
lifestyle wave.
Yeah, you know,
but you know what? As we're talking about the
place we were staying and the experience and what it's like to drive on snow, you know, coming from a very different perspective than
I feel very strongly about this, despite the fact that there were some bumper cars happening at this program. Apparently there is something to be said for the lifestyle person who gives an interesting perspective on things.
Yeah. Cause you're all going to say the same thing.
Not everybody wants to hear. Yeah. That's what we said. Want to know that, but I think they give a really, like, to the person who's like, I don't want to listen to a bunch of gearheads talk about cars. I just want to, like, get more fun, and what was it like? And that actually is really valuable. So not at all what we're generally doing, but still valuable in its own world. I don't want it to sound like we're just like
harping on the influencers.
Right. There is a strong value to influencers. I like the influencers. They can be fun too.
Certainly. On Fast Women, you and Eileen, you know, you talk about the cars and your experience with the cars, but you also talk about the larger experience of the trips that you're taking, the places you're going, you know. And so
it's not just the car, it's the adventure. But there's some lifestyle folks out there that I adore. One named Claudia, she's my favorite. She has this really cool poofy red coat. I think she was on that. Hopefully she wasn't one of the people who smooshed a car. I'll have to ask her. Hopefully it wasn't Claudia. Okay.
Smooshed a car.
I know that. It sounds so much more delicate than what actually happened.
Yeah. So I didn't smoosh any cars.
Good job, Robbie.
Did you smack any snowbanks, though?
I did not smack any snowbanks.
Can you make that the title of this episode, Smacked Snowbanks?
Smooshed cars. It was because they allowed, you know, part of the program was, put the car in snow mode. When you put in snow mode, and you can see where if I were driving on the road, especially if I wasn't used to driving on snow, how helpful that is. Because as you're turning the wheel, it reduces the amount of acceleration you can input. So that's great, because sometimes, you know, like, you're turning, and then you're putting your. It was really helpful. But
you're not exaggerating there. In fact, you're very much understating that.
You just turn it, and all of a sudden, no acceleration.
Yeah, when the stability control is turned on, and you're on snow or ice, and you've got the wheel cranked, you can put your foot all the way down, the accelerator pedal all the way down to the floor.
Nothing.
Nope. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Which is good. Which is a good thing, because you just slide off into nowhere. Yeah. Because. But then, you know, they're like, put it in sport mode and turn off the traction control. And they're like, yeah. And then you can feel like how well those Blizzaks work, especially on the ice.
They were shockingly good
on the ice slalom in sport mode with the traction control off. I mean, they're sliding everywhere, but it is so much better. It's better than walking on there, because I tried, again, almost fell down while trying to put a GoPro on the car.
I'm even more sad that I missed this, because I would have liked to have seen the flail that probably went along with the almost falling.
My arms are so long.
Like, oh, like one arm. Oh my God, Robbie's falling. Everybody,
one arm was in Montana, yet the other one made it all the way up to Canada.
Exactly. That would have been great to see.
No, it's always eye opening when you drive around on those Blizzaks and you have, you know, in a controlled environment where, you know, you're not, you know, there's no potential for you hitting other, well, I guess you could other cars. Yeah. You can't
scratch that, strike that.
Limited potential to get into trouble.
It was great, but it's also a great reminder, like, you know, even with those Blizzaks, even with traction control, even with ABS, even with everything, at the end of that ice slalom where we were just driving on a sheet of ice, you slam, you're like, okay, now slam on the brakes, and you still slid for a good 5-10 feet.
And, you know, to describe what this was like, actually, it was a lot more than 10 feet. Yeah, the maximum speed that at least Perry Stern and I, we were driving together. The maximum speed that either of us saw on the ice was about 23 miles an hour. So you're going through this, you know, pretty good length slalom. And the most speed you can get up to, you know, without losing it is about 22, 23 miles an hour. And then you get to the end and slam on the brakes and you slide for, you know, probably another 50 or 60 feet.
You smack another two cars is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, as you're slamming on the brakes, and you if you've ever driven in the snow and you know what happens when you put on the brakes and all of a sudden you're not stopping, there's a car just like, you're just barely like, no.
Yeah, you're just waiting. Oh God, yeah, please.
This was definitely, if you've been driving on this and you slammed on the brakes, you would hit the car in front of you with enough force to have them hit the car in front of them, to have that person hit the car in front of them. So when the authorities are like, hey, it's really icy, it's just a sheet of ice, don't drive, maybe don't drive.
Yeah, stay home. Or stay wherever you are.
Even with some of the, you know, the best, you know, winter tires on the planet, you're...
unless you're driving something with studs, that's about the only way you're going to get any significant traction.
Yeah. And most places, I think, they've outlawed them or outlawing them just because they're so horrible to the road.
Yeah, it depends. Like, in Scandinavia, especially in northern parts of Scandinavia, where the way that they handle the roads in the wintertime is they don't actually they don't use any salt or sand. They plow the roads, you know, so there's a layer of packed snow on the roads for the whole winter. And so you're almost never coming in contact directly with the pavement. You know, and so there, studded tires are allowed and, in fact, encouraged.
Yeah. They know what they're doing, though.
Yeah.
They do. They get caught like, a lot of
we're all trying. I was trying to do the flick a lot with the QX60, which is not built for that. I got it a few times.
You don't think?
It's not built for flicking.
I don't know. I feel like we'd have to check. I feel like it is. I feel like you're terribly mistaken.
What kind of speed did you get in the figure eight? Or what was your time in the figure eight?
Oh, at the end? It was like 32? I got third, but I had a horrible, you know, the first circle, like as you're going in, I just, both times, I was just horrible, because I was trying to flick it and I didn't. And so then I just understeered all the way through and I'm like, oh my God. And then I added like 3 seconds to my time with that. I'm like counting. I'm like 1, 2, 3, like trying to like correct and then come back out. So I ended up getting third and I was very disappointed.
I also got third, but by the time that we were doing it at the end of the day,
it was icy,
around the inner portion of the circle was pretty polished. All of the snow had moved to the outside. So for my second timed run, I actually went wide around the outside where there was actually some snow to get a grip on, and I managed to get like 29.7.
Oh, see, that's what I should have done.
But the guy, and I came in third. Perry did like a 29.3. The guy who won.
Who was it?
Kurt from Edmonds. I don't know his last name.
Okay.
He got like 27.5. He was like 2 seconds faster than us.
Wow.
Did he flip? Was he able to drift it or was he just like on the outside?
I think he just went wide like I did. Managed to get a better track than I did.
Because if you could have got a nice drift around that, especially wide, you're looking like a 25, but nope.
I think it's funny how like 2 seconds doesn't sound like a lot unless you've ever done anything like But it's a lot when you're driving. Like when you're trying to, for speed, 2 seconds is like.
Especially, I mean, this was not a particularly large figure eight course. Yeah, I mean, you're talking 30 seconds, you know, to get through this thing. And 2 seconds is a pretty substantial difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just counting. I'm like one, two, three. Somebody's like,
I know. You just feel the time ticking away as you're understeering out towards that snowbank. And it's just.
And hitting the body.
And then the other thing that we had to do at the end of this was we had to stop. We had to hit the brakes at the right time to stop inside of this box that was basically just slightly longer than the QX60. So we had to figure out where to hit the brakes so we could stop in time. And if you went outside of the box, you got a 5-second penalty.
Did you go outside of the box? Did you slide right through the box?
I did on multiple occasions, but on my timed runs, I did not. So
anytime
I
have something where I have to stop inside of a box on ice, I don't. I either stop way before the box, so like the grill is in the box because I'm so worried it'll slide through. I'm like, wait, that's not right. Or I stop on the other side of the box, and it's like the exhaust pipe is in the box and the rest of me is out. I'm like either way through. I'm like, I don't put a box at the end. Just give me a thing to stop at. I'm okay. Don't give a box. Apparently I don't like boxes.
I hit the box twice at the end, I think.
Oh, shush.
That's what essentially helped me get third. Cause I was like, oh, this sucks because it had gotten so icy and snowy that the stop where you apply brakes before, it was now like a car and a half before that. So as soon as you came out of that figure eight, as soon as you were straight, like you could maybe go maybe half a car length before you had to put the brakes on. Because everyone missed the box. People just...
One of the interesting things that we learned, you know, even when you turn off the stability control on the QX60, there's still a torque vectoring system on the front and the rear axles that just uses the brakes. So, you know, when it's detecting slip on one side of the, on one side or the other, it'll apply the brakes to the side that's slipping and send the torque to the opposite side to try to get some grip. And on the oval, course that we were doing, I heard this grinding sound as I was going around the corners. And what that was actually, it was applying the brakes because I was going rather swiftly. And by the time I finished and I opened the car door to let Perry get in and drive, it's like, ooh, brakes, cooked brakes.
Oh, yeah. Geez, you can smell them.
I cooked the brakes on the slalom because I was drifting back and like I was doing wide drift. I'm like, wee! So by doing that, because I was accelerating, letting off right at the apex and then hitting it again so the car would slide. So the car was like, oh, I got to do the brakes. So I had some melted brakes because of that. Melted That's sort of the brakes. Weird thing about those brake-based vector systems is that, you know, torque vectoring is that you can cook the brakes. There's a Ezra over at Car and Driver. He had the Raptor? Bronco. The Bronco Raptor. And he was on the sand dunes. And you can the brakes are essentially on fire. There's video. Like,
you just smell it's a little flame shooting out as he's driving along.
So go over to Car and Driver, look up Bronco, Raptor, Ezra, and should be a video. Yeah, there should be a video or a photo or something. But like you can see, the rear brakes are just glowing red.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to try the Q50 at all?
No, I was trying to just make the focus on the new car. I'm capturing video, and so there's, you know, when you're capturing video, like all the sort of like, hey, you want to try this other thing? You're like, no. Hey, do you want to eat lunch? I'm like, I don't have time for that.
Food, food's for losers.
Eating's for chumps.
Yeah, no one eats.
Perry and I both got a chance to do a couple of laps of the figure eight in the Q50, which is the last remaining car from Infiniti now that the Q60 is gone. And so the QX60 is based on a front wheel drive architecture. It's a transverse engine. It's the same platform as the Pathfinder, Nissan Pathfinder. And it will deliver up to 50% of the torque to the rear axle. But you know, it's front biased. Whereas the Q50 sedan is a rear-wheel drive platform, and it's more rear-biased. And it is one that is definitely a lot easier to do the Scandinavian flick and get the back end of that thing around. But you can feel it, you know, when you're going through some of those maneuvers, as it's shifting the torque, doing the torque transfer back and forth between the front and rear axles. It you got to be paying attention all the time and ready to respond if it does something at any point where you're not, you weren't quite expecting it.
You can't be not ready or you're in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's like, "Wee! Oh, well, now I'm pointed the wrong direction again."
Yeah. Dang it all.
But yeah. The QX60 was really nice to drive, you know, driving up from, we stayed in Big Sky and we drove up to West Yellowstone Airport, where they had the track set up for testing, because the airport gets so much snow that it's closed for airport operations through the winter. So they were, they had some courses set up on the taxiways and runways there, and also had a snow cross course, you know, sort of a rally cross course, which was also a lot of fun to try out in the QX60.
Yeah, it had elevation changes and everything, which I'm always fun. It's always funner when you're doing those snow drives when you have elevation change.
I think any track's more fun when there's elevation change. When it's just straight, it's not as fun. When you like come up a hill and you're like, what's on the other side? Whoa! It's always kind of exciting. I love that moment. Oh, God, turn right.
Nicole's always driving around the edge of cliffs.
Cliff!
When you get some decreasing radius turns with a late apex, you know, trying to hit those just right so you're not understeering right into the snowbank on the opposite side.
Yep.
We had a very enjoyable time and learned a lot about the benefits of proper winter tires. And I had a chance to chat with Iris Ocasio, who's a consumer product strategy manager at Bridgestone, about those, and I'll drop that in here somewhere. It was a good day. So we're here in Montana today, driving a bunch of Infinities on snow and ice. And one of the key parts of this is that they're all equipped with Bridgestone Blizzak tires. And on Wheel Bearings podcast, we often tell our listeners how important it is to use winter tires, but I want to hear from Bridgestone, what is the importance of winter tires versus all season tires or summer tires? How do they work differently?
Yeah. So with Bridgestone, English is hard sometimes for me. The differences with tires is really like what conditions you're going to be driving in. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a strong stance. Let me rephrase. We highly recommend, if you're going to be driving in maybe 45 degrees or less on ice, packed snow, we highly recommend a dedicated winter tire. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, if you're in a mixed climate area, you can get away with an all-weather tire, like our Bridgestone Weather Peak, that has that three-peak mountain snowflake. But if you are particularly like where we are in Montana, where you are getting a lot of snow and a lot of ice or any freezing overnight of ice, you definitely want a dedicated winter tire. And the differences here is with a summer tire, you're going to have a stiffer tread compound. So that's what's going to give you your precision handling. And that's what's going to have more of that stickiness on the tread. Mm-hmm. So you can, of course, grab your terrain or grab your pavement a little bit better. With an all-season tire, you kind of get the best of both worlds because it's like in the middle of tread softness.
More of a jack of all trades and master of none, though.
Well, it depends on what you're going for.
Yeah.
So with an all season tire, like it depends because you have also like a sliding scale on those as well. Uh-huh. Like you have something that's a little bit sportier that of course is going to perform better in like a summer type pack, or you have something that's a little bit more, say this compound's a little softer, that is going to be more of your three-peak, that's still going to give you that comfortable drive that you're used to in that long that long wear life. But on the flip side, you still have that winter traction that you're used to. Mm-hmm. But when you're going into harsher winter conditions, having a softer tread, which is something that we do with the Blizzak particularly, and I'll get into the multi-cell here soon, that talks about more of the ice side of the equation. With your particularly harsh winters, you want to have that dedicated tire because it is a little softer. So as temperatures drop, especially in your different tread compounds, the tire gets stiffer.
So the rubber itself, the tread, yes, gets with a summer compound, it gets harder and it doesn't grip.
At higher / lower temperatures, yeah, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So with winter tires, we call it the glass point. That point is lower, so it's designed to withstand lower temperatures, and it still maintains that tread flexibility.
Stays more pliable.
Exactly, yeah, that's perfectly phrased. So it keeps that pliability. That way you can still have that good optimized contact patch. That way you can grip better on these wintry terrains.
Because I think the thing people don't necessarily understand about tires is the rubber, when you're driving down the road, the rubber is actually deforming a little bit to around the texture of the road surface, whatever that texture is. And so it needs to be pliable enough to get a grip on that. That's how you get your traction. And winter tires are specifically formulated to maintain that in cold temperatures, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's something that we stress a lot, especially like with tire safety. It's really important to look at where you're living and like where you're driving just to make sure that you have the right tire for you, because truly the tire is the only thing that separates your car from the ground.
Right.
So having a tire that's right for you is incredibly important. And one thing that we've really showcased here today, with the Blizzak particularly, is especially on ice or that packed snow, what really gets you into trouble is that layer of water that sits on top of the surface. And with multi-cell, what that does is that wicks away the water from the surface so you can optimize your rubber to ground traction, if that makes sense.
Right.
And on the flip side, with the softer compound, and especially the types that we have in both of our Blizzak products, the MV2 and the LM, which is what we're driving on today, it packs in that snow, because the best traction you are going to get is snow-on-snow traction.
So you mentioned the word sipes. Can you explain what that is?
I can show you a little bit better, but it's all of the little cuts that you see tread block.
Those little diagonal slices.
Yep. The slices.
That you see particularly on winter tires.
Correct. And you'll see it on a few other, like,
all seasons have it to some degree.
But
summer tires don't. They have solid blocks of rubber.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, those slices in the tire and the tread blocks are what's going to give you a little bit more traction so you can, like, pack in the snow a little bit more.
Okay. And the multi-cell, is that something that's unique to to Blizzak tires?
It is. And it's we're incredibly proud of the Japan development that, you know, essentially started multi-cell. And the best way I can explain it is when we are going through the compounding process, so we add a chemical into the compound, and as we're curing that tire and as the temperature rises, that chemical evaporates and it creates those pores, those divots that are what wicks away the water.
So it creates kind of a porous rubber rather than a solid block of rubber.
Correct. And, like, my favorite analogy for it is, you know, when you're making a cake and you have all of your, like, liquid ingredients and then you bake it in the oven and you pull it out and you cut into it and you see all of the pores?
Yeah.
That is exactly what's happening with these tires.
Okay. And so the water gets wicked up. The water from the ice surface, because as you drive across it, or, you know, just the sun shining on it, you can have a little bit of melting, a thin film that gets wicked up into those cells so that you get direct rubber on ice grip.
Okay. Yeah, that is exactly right.
Okay, great. So what else should people be thinking about with selecting winter tires? You mentioned the three peak symbol. Can you explain for people what that is?
Yeah, that is the Three Peak Mountain Snowflake certification. So it is a industry standard certification that shows that you have tire that is capable in like light winter conditions. Mm-hmm. So more of like your packed snow type conditions, really. That still gives you that traction. Mm-hmm. So if you're like me in Nashville, where the city shuts down when there's a threat of snow or ice, but you still need to be able to get out, like that is a great candidate for an all-weather tire. Mm-hmm. Now again, if you're here, you definitely want more of a dedicated winner.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we differentiate. And one thing that I want to call out specifically is when you start seeing your breath,
yeah,
that's maybe when you want to start thinking about changing into your winter tires.
Yeah.
Especially if it is consistent.
Yep.
And if it's like 6 months out of the year, you definitely want to have something that's going to give you that traction. And also it expands the life of the tire.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, storing your winter tires as you're switching them out is incredibly important. We always recommend that you clean them off, keep them away from the sun to avoid any UV degradation, but really having a well-maintained winter tire is going to get you through a couple of seasons or a few seasons.
And even with winter tires, if it's cold, but you don't have any snow, it's still important to use those winter tires, right?
Absolutely. Like, if it's cold, you still have that almost, like, mini layer of ice that mm-hmm. sits on top of the surface, and having a winter tire is really important for that. Now, if you get warmer climates where it kind of melts, at that point you can kind of get away with a three-peak.
Okay.
Or with an all-weather tire.
Great.
And then, of course, your standard all seasons are going to deliver, like, mild winter performance, and it's going to give you more of that comfortable, traditional, like, long tread life and the comfortable ride that you're used to, but that's really just a very personal decision on, mm-hmm. on what you're driving on, and, of course, vehicle safety, so having a good tire is really going to help you out in these scenarios.
Yeah, you know, as you said earlier, you know, the tire is, that is your contact with the road.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if you have a car with 100 horsepower or 1,000 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
Those four little patches of rubber is all that is transmitting all that power to the road. And for your braking as well, and
absolutely.
Steering.
Yep.
So if those four patches of rubber, you know, about the size of the palm of your hand, aren't getting a good grip, doesn't matter what else you got, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's truly astounding how much your ride can be improved or worsened by the tires that you select. So that's why I think it's super important that you reach out to your favorite tire professional,
mm-hmm.
figure out what works for you. We do have quite a bit of offerings, but really figuring out what you're trying to do with those tires as well is really important.
Yeah. All right. Well, Iris, thank you very much.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
Yeah, any day you get to do ice driving.
But it was good.
Like a Bridgestone has like a winter driving.
Oh, have you ever done that? I did that.
In Colorado.
I think it's Colorado Springs.
It's in Colorado. So if you're like, you have money.
You're
in Colorado.
And they, you know, they offer really a thing where they do, because I was talking.
And they teach you how, like, they teach you, like, the things to do. They did, like,
well, and
don't
they'll also
slam.
Teach, like, kids, like, not little kids, but, like, if you're a new driver,
it's brilliant
for teenagers, because they will help teenagers learn the right way to do it before they learn the wrong way to do it.
Yeah, that's, I'm always a big, like, when my wife wanted to learn how to ride a motorcycle, I was like, oh, no, you're going to take class. Don't learn from me, because I'm sure I've been doing things wrong for. At that point, how old was I? Like 20-something years, like 30 years, 25 years. I've probably been doing things wrong. So don't learn from me. Learn from a professional who's going to tell you the right thing.
Yeah, it's, Steamboat Springs is the Bridgestone Winter Driving School, and they've got a variety of different classes, safety classes, performance classes. They'll do group and custom classes. And you can I'll put the link in the show notes. It's winterdrive.com. But it's definitely worth considering, especially if you live somewhere where you get these kinds of conditions. The basic safety class is actually only $625, which is not bad at all.
Like, it sounds like a lot of money, but guys, you get, like, if you have it, you learn so much from these guys, because they put you in controlled ish situations, and they also teach you, like, how would you do this? And you do it, and you think, like, yeah, I got this. He's like, I'm going to tell you why everything you did there, you didn't do the way you should have done. So they let you see how the wrong way, and then they'll have you do it completely the wrong way to show you, if you completely fumble a situation, this is how the car handles. It's very, very good at teaching, and it's worth the money as a safety thing. It's an investment in your safety.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty great. Like, just the steering, like, you know, don't, if you steer too hard, you're sliding on. Like, unwind your steering. You're like, that seems counterintuitive. Just do it. Just do it. Yeah. And all of a sudden you catch and you'll do your turn. You're like, oh, wow. Yeah.
And they let you do things over and over. You're like, I don't get it. I don't get it. And all of a sudden you feel like, oh, if I do that. You're like, that's what you're trying to get me to learn. Got it. You know.
And they'll teach you how to shuffle steer.
It's the kind of stuff that you won't learn. You won't really learn on your own. And you certainly won't be able to learn it in a safe environment on your own. Mm-hmm. you do need to get some training to do this. And I know, I mean, I was fortunate, you know, I started my career in engineering working on ABS systems and, you know, got thrown in the deep end, you know, doing winter tests. And I learned so much about driving from that experience, you know, and that is one of the things I miss about my engineering days is, you know, doing the winter testing. You know, because you get to, you're exploring the limits of the vehicle in that controlled environment, and you learn a lot about how the vehicle behaves and how you can control it and be a safer driver, and it makes a huge difference. It's definitely worthwhile. And even the top class, the what they call fifth gear fastest ride on ice class at the Bridgestone School, is $3,300 for, looks like it's a 2-day class. But you know, the entry class is first gear, is $339. The second gear class is $625. So, you know, you could take, you know, those two over a couple of days, you know, for $1,000, and you'll probably, for the average driver, you'll probably learn pretty much everything you need to know to be safe on the road in any conditions.
Yeah. And especially if you don't. Especially if you don't want to teach your kid bad habits. That's the other thing.
Yep.
Or unlearn all your bad habits.
Yes.
Yeah. Unlearn everything that you thought you were doing right. You're like, I've been doing this wrong my whole life. Oops.
Yeah. Because if you haven't done something like this before, chances are you have bad habits that need to be unlearned.
Like, you don't think you do. Oh, you're going thinking like, I'm fine. I got this. And even I think every time I drive anything, like if it's like a racetrack or whatever, there's always some little thing. He's like, see how you put your thumb like that on the steering wheel? Don't do that. I'm like, why? He's like, move your thumb. Oh, and like they tell you these little things you don't even know that you're doing. Yeah. And it's like, how did that make a difference? So the more you know, the more subtle and detailed the instruction they give you. They will find something you're not doing right.
Yeah. And probably the single most important thing to learn, whether you're on snow or ice or pavement, is keep your eyes where you want, looking where you want to go.
Don't
look off to the side. Look where you want to go. So, you know, you're looking, you know, through the corner you're coming up on towards the next one. And if you look where in the direction where you want the vehicle to go, your hands will generally follow.
Yeah, your body will make you do that.
Yeah.
I can still remember, like, they were having us push these vehicles and kind of there was an area where it's like, you're going to push and people are going to end up in the snow here. Like, you're going to do this. Like, they knew it was going to happen. And I really went in the snow. And I, like, totally was like, oh, God. And he's everyone else is going, like, sort of, like, say, slightly to the left. I went a little bit more to the right. He's like, so where were you looking? And I'm like, to the left. He's like, I don't think so. I think you were looking over here. Look where you want to go. I was like, okay, I'm sorry. So I always think of the guy telling me, look where you want to go. And as I'm stuck
look
in the snow.
Look where you want to go.
Men are digging me out.
If you look at a cone, you're going to hit a cone.
Yep.
So so what did you think overall of the Pathfinder, Robbie? Not the Pathfinder, the QX60.
It's not. I think, you know, again, I think Nissan has, you know, recently sort of dug itself out of this hole that it's been in for a couple of years. I talked to them a little bit about that, and they're like, yeah. I think the QX, you know, we drove it up there. I sat in the back seat on the way to and from the airport, drove it in the snow. It's a good car. I applaud them for sort of, you know, it feels nicer than previous Infinities that I've driven. It's, you know, they're doing the right thing is what they're doing. And, you know, it can be difficult, especially in the high end for, you know, that's the Nissan luxury brand. And you can get lost as that brand. I mean, Acura sort of got lost in there for a while. And, you know, sometimes when you drive a Lexus, you're like, why wouldn't I just get the Toyota version of this? And so, you know, it's, you know, I think the QX60, it delivers, you know, most of everything that someone wants from a luxury brand. It's comfortable, you know, massage seats, comfortable in the front, a lot of leg room in the back, you know, appropriate, you know, power, appropriate, you know, drivability, all-wheel drive, which everyone wants now. And of course, the snow mode. So if you're out in the middle of, you know, Montana and you're hitting snow or ice, or if you're in Michigan or really anywhere where there's snow, you know, you'll if you have Blizzak's, awesome. But if you have all seasons, you have snow mode on. You should be fine as long as you're not driving like a maniac. Slow down. That's the really everything in the snow. A lot of snow driving is like slow down and think ahead. Like anything you think you should have done, do that way beforehand. You feel like you should stop, maybe, you know, lift off and then slowly depress the brakes, like, you know, five times further than you normally would.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first lessons I learned as an engineer working on anti-lock brake systems was Newton was right. You know, F equals MA.
Who knew?
Absolutely true. You know, reduce that acceleration, reduce that velocity, the forces become much, much lower.
And, yeah, you know, mass, man.
You have a much better chance of surviving. Yeah. If you just slow down. Cool. All right, Nicole.
Yes.
What'd you drive?
I drove the 2023 Jeep Grand Wagoneer L Obsidian.
Ooh,
nice.
Yeah. So I had a very fancy, very expensive luxury SUV this week. Anyone want to take bets on the pricing of the 2023 Jeep Grand Wagoneer, can't even say it, Grand Wagoneer L Obsidian 4x4?
Somewhere around $115,000.
Okay, what's your price? See, I'm just going to make you do price. Forget this destination.
I was going to say like 110, 112. But
you both lose.
Oh, yeah.
You both went over. It's actually,
really?
Yeah, it's actually the one I had as equipped in Nicole's driveway right now is $107.30.
I should have said $1. I don't know why I said.
Yeah, $107,030.
Oh, okay.
And it's the base on this.
So it's not quite as well equipped as the one that I drove a little while ago.
Probably not. I guess not. So
the
base
closer to 115.
Yeah, the base on this one before you put bells and whistles, I mean, it already has them. Before you put more bells and whistles, is $98,000. But this one has, and I love this appearance package. It has the Obsidian appearance package, which basically just murders out your SUV. It makes everything black, and that is $5,500. I would totally do that for all the black little bits and pieces. And it's a cool appearance package. I like it. I think a black car looks cute when it's, or cool when it's like all black.
Yeah.
There's no color, just black. It's like Batman. It's just black.
It's hard to be stealthy in something as massive as a Grand Wagoneer Elk.
But you try. Well, you know,
no one's going to see. No one's going to see me.
No one's going to see me. I'm all in
just going to fade into the background.
I'm the size of a tank, but no one will ever notice me. Well, it was funny. I went to get, like I do, I went to Crumble Cookies to get cookies. And as I was waiting for them to bring my cookies to the car, the guy's like,
did you send some to Jim Morrison?
I did not send some to Jim, but I was like, wow. I'm like, the guy's like, this car is really cool. We were looking at it out the window. That is really cool. I'm like, thank you. As he's, you know, reaching up to hand me the cookies through the window.
A little step stool so you can get in.
Yeah, a little step stool so you can get in. I was going to take my mom out to lunch, and I'm like, I don't think she can get in this. Even with the running boards that, like, deploy, the automatic running boards, which, okay, so you guys like those that they deploy automatically?
I don't like them because I'm tall.
Yeah.
I'm tall, so they sort of like get in the way for me.
Would you rather have the fixed ones? They're there whether you want them or not, or the ones that go ka-thunk and close up? Because I have strong opinions on this little tiny feature.
Well, I would say it depends. You know, if like the Wagoneer, you know, has an air spring suspension, so when you put it in park, it lowers itself down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite as critical to have it on. Have those deployable running boards, you know, or just running boards on something like that. But I guess, you know, if you are of not quite as tall as Robbie or even myself, you might appreciate having that extra step up
but
there.
But not the extra step, a deployable extra step or a fixed extra step.
I'm going to say I don't like the deployable ones only because the reason I would have a vehicle that tall was because I was taking it off road. Or I was driving in. I was driving somewhere where there's probably going to be salt on the road.
Okay.
So I'm driving it in very harsh conditions, and that's under the car. So it's just going to get destroyed.
So,
I do. You know what I do like? I like the little like metal bar that comes out that has a little sandpaper on it.
Oh,
like some cars.
Sort of a rock rail, I think.
Yeah, like a rock rail almost.
Yeah,
just so
I like those
step.
Better. I like those better.
I don't like the ones. I do like the rock rail one better. I don't like it's really neat and it's this cool fancy feature and it's huge. Like it is a large step. Like it's
like
not,
this. It's like a bed. Yeah. It's like 6 feet.
You can surf on
like it comes
things.
Out and there's like a family of
there's
kittens
a little
sleeping
pillow.
On it.
Yeah, you could just like oh sorry we were napping here. But what I don't like and this isn't a Jeep thing. This is just these kind. If you don't timer, if you open the door quickly and you step out.
It gets you.
That's a good point.
It gets you.
Yeah.
So you're because if it's just there already, you're stepping over. When it comes out, it's like if your foot is too fast, it's like it's coming down as your foot is coming down. The number of times I've gotten dirt and salt and whatever all
on the back
the
of your
back
pant
of my
leg.
Pants. I'm like, gosh, dang it. So I have to remember to sort of like wait and step. So I just want them to always be there.
As a woman of action, I can see how that would be very annoying.
As a woman of action, yes.
You're not like opening the door and then waiting. You're like, I gotta go.
Right. I'm like, I'm moving. Get out of the way. I got a plane to catch. Yeah. So
you just gotta be a little more relaxed. You know, take your time.
Woman of action.
At this point in my life, the woman of action. I'm going with Robbie saying, I am a woman of action. I need the running boards to be ready the instant I step out of the car. So, but I really like this. I mean, the thing is, it's huge. I mean, and this is the L, so it's a long wheelbase. So it is absolutely gigantic. I drove it to the airport. And oh god,
did people just start getting in?
Well, yeah, exactly. People are like, here for the ride. But the thing is, so
people
I go
standing
through,
there in the aisle with their bags, waiting to step in.
So the Sumner Tunnel, the bane of my existence, which is this beat up tunnel that you have to take in and out of Logan Airport, and it always feels like you're going to get like you don't have enough room to drive it in a Miata. It feels like you don't have enough room in the Jeep Grand Wagoneer L. I swear to God, my heart rate was like up, like oh my god, don't hit the wall. It's so close. It feels absolutely huge, and it is a challenge to park because it's just so big. You're coming around. It's like. You know, cruise ship sized. If you can get over this, if you can get past the size, like if you want a big SUV, if you can get past the fact that the challenges of just driving a big vehicle, I really like this. I think it's very smooth. That air suspension is fantastic. So you don't, it's very controlled. Like you would think this giant thing is going to like woo wobble around. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. It's actually a really nice ride. It's super comfortable inside. I mean, it is really comfy. The captain's chairs in the second row, I could just sleep in those. I could just like if I had a kid that I had to drop off at practice, I'd be like, just knock on the window, guys, because mom's going to be asleep in the second row while you guys are playing soccer. It is such a comfortable interior. And what I really like, and this is think something that Robbie would appreciate, you can actually just get into the third row and sit there. Like, it doesn't matter how tall you are. I have my husband get in.
Oh,
he's 6'3".
Yeah.
And it's not even like you have to squinch your knees. It's not like a narrow spot. It comes so far forward. Like, you can just turn and step right up into it. There is such a large space. between the second row seats and the entry into the third row. And you can sit back there without, like, he's just kind of sitting. Like, he's not, like, his knees aren't squished. He's not having to, you know, feel like he's mushed. That is a spacious third row for that vehicle. If you're a tall guy, this is a good car for you if you're going to get stuck in that third row.
Cool.
Yeah, no, and to what you were saying about, you know, the feeling of the size, you know, like going through a tunnel, you mm-hmm. know, from the first time that I drove the Wagoneer, what, 2021, I think, is when they had the drive program for that.
I think so. That sounds right.
You know, driving that thing in Manhattan was nightmarish because the Wagoneer is 4 inches wider than a Ford Expedition or Lincoln Navigator and 2.5 inches wider than the GM SUVs, the Suburban and Tahoe and Yukon and Escalade. So it is far and away the widest of any of these.
Right.
So you really feel it, you know, when especially in urban areas, you know, you feel that, you know, the lanes seem to be encroaching on you.
Exactly. Like it's like you're in some like movie and the lanes, it's just getting, you know, when a hallway stretches out in a nightmare and never ends, you feel like the lane's just getting narrower and narrower and narrower as you're driving along. So, I mean, and that's like, don't buy a great big SUV if you're not ready to deal with that. Like that's an any SUV problem. This particularly with this one, cause it is bigger, but any big SUV. But I mean, my gosh, it's got passenger room for miles, cargo room for miles. It's got the tech. It has 3 screens in the front of the car. You've got your, actually 4, I guess, if you count the instrument cluster. But there's like the big infotainment screen, then there's one that actually retracts below it. You push a little button, it goes whoop, and it retracts sort of into the dashboard. But otherwise, it has like the massaging seats and the heating and cooling and the temperature that you can control from there. But behind it, there's a little bit of storage and like your USB ports and little like nooks and crannies to put your stuff. And then there is a passenger screen that I rightly could not see this time, other than that existed. I could like, you know, see the outline of it, but I can't see anything that's on it because I shouldn't be able to because I'm the driver and I shouldn't be able to be distracted by whatever's happening halfway across the car like that. So you've got that screen in there. It's, you know, it's got 4-wheel drive. It has, I just love that they call this a 3-liter inline six. It's the Hurricane twin turbo, 510 horsepower, 500 pound feet of torque. They say 14 miles per gallon city, 19 miles per gallon highway. That is not fantabulous, but if you are spending $107,030 on an SUV, I would hazard just a little guess that your fuel economy is not such a big concern for you.
There's that.
Yeah.
Like
I have my own.
It's still
oil
a thirsty
field.
Beast, though.
It is a thirsty beast. So there's no denying it's a thirsty beast, but it's a thirsty beast with a Hurricane under the hood that moves. Like you mash the gas pedal on that, and the thing really moves. It gets out of its own way, which you for some
considering this thing weighs 3 tons.
You know? Right. That's I mean, and you feel this is a large, heavy vehicle, and it feels that way. Like it feels substantial. I don't want it to sound like it feels like this ponderous thing. It just feels substantial. You're in a big SUV that's designed to be comfortable and bold and in your face, and that's exactly what it does. But it's expensive. It doesn't get great fuel economy, but otherwise it's and it has deployable running boards that I dislike, but otherwise I love it.
So one more question for you.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the design goes relative to the standard length Wagoneer.
Yeah.
You know, some people have said that, you know, because basically what they did is they added 12 inches to make the L.
Right.
You know, and I think half of that is in front of the rear axle. The other half is behind the rear axle. You know, so the rear doors are longer. The seats are actually in the same position. So you don't actually get any more third row seat room, but that doesn't matter because there's plenty anyway.
There's so much
But you
there.
Have a lot more cargo space for, you know, up to 8 people. But what do you think about the proportions of it now compared to the standard Wagoneer?
Well, I think the standard, I mean, it doesn't, a foot is... It's a small amount, but it's a huge amount. I mean, that's a good, like, you know, put your hands out, you know, like to see a foot. That's a good amount of space. It makes it, I mean, it just looks huge. The regular Wagoneer, Grand Wagoneer, you see it. It's like a big SUV. This one is like almost like an in-your-face. Like it is so much
like a
larger.
Train.
It is really large. It's going to attract attention just for sort of like, who the heck needs a car this big? You know, that's the question you think when you see this. Does she have a family of 20? Like, how do you need this much
vehicle?
Is it the
Brady Bunch?
But if you have a lot of people, you have a lot of cargo, you want to be able to tow, and you want to have all this luxury, it puts it together. I think I like the look of the standard wheelbase better, but it's not, if I had to pick, because I'm spending that kind of money, I'd pick the standard wheelbase. Also, I don't need that extra cargo room. But if you need it, by all means, go for it. But you, if you look at them in profile, especially, there is a difference.
So that's really the only place you're going to see a difference is in profile.
You look at the profile, you line them up next to each other at the dealership before you spend your $100,000, and you look and you see, do I really want it to look that big for the extra foot of cargo room? I don't know. Do you need that extra foot?
That's if you're picking up executives from the airport, it's great.
Right.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So that was the Jeep Grand Wagoneer L Obsidian 4x4, which I liked. Overall, like, two thumbs up. Like it.
Two thumbs up.
All right. Two thumbs up.
All right. I had the 2023 Nissan Pathfinder Platinum, which is why I kept
calling everything a Pathfinder.
QX60. Yeah, I mean, under the skin, it's basically the same thing as a QX60. Same platform, same powertrain and everything. But where the QX60's got a little more upscale, luxurious,
fancy
look to it, and much, much nicer interior, more premium looking interior. The Pathfinder, especially this current generation that they launched a couple of years ago, it's pulled in a few design cues from some of the early Pathfinders of the 80s and 90s. So it's a little more rugged looking, even in the Platinum trim that I had. They also have the Rock Creek, which I was originally scheduled to get, but things happened, and so I ended up with a Platinum instead.
Ended up in a creek?
Huh?
Did it end up in a creek?
Did it go in the creek?
No. It's just I needed to get it a day earlier, and it wasn't available yet. So they gave me the Platinum. But anyway, the look of it, compared to the previous generation Pathfinder, which was kind of nondescript, blobbish,
it was depressing.
It was kind of depressing.
It was because the Pathfinder was like this really
blobbish.
I did say
when the Pathfinder came to market, it was so cool looking. You're like, oh, it was like an adventure. It was like an adventure SUV.
And the original Pathfinder.
Yeah, and it had if it had four doors, you couldn't tell because the other two were sort of like disappeared into the side because of the chicken tax, and which is a whole other thing. If you get bored, you can look up on Google. But yeah, and then it got the opposite of that.
All right, before I go on, I got to ask, what are you sewing?
No, I'm the dog, somehow messed up the cat's toy, so I'm trying to fix it.
He was taking a stitch or two.
So the dogs are in here, and he's destroying it, so if I don't fix it now while he's staring at me.
I also thought Robbie was sewing, and I was going to ask him, what are you sewing?
I figured it was a costume for one of your bands for an upcoming gig or something, but you never know.
Someone asked us to wear something sparkly for a gig, and I'm like, all right.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway, the Pathfinder, it's got a little more chunky, rugged look to it now, which I think is good. The proportions are good. It's got kind of the blistered fender look of the early generation Pathfinders. If you look in the grill, you can kind of see the three horizontal slots that were there on that first generation. It's a good looking vehicle. The interior is roomy, not quite as roomy as the Telluride that I had the week before. And particularly in the cargo area, the Telluride had more cargo space behind the third row than the Pathfinder has. But, if you're not using that third row, you can always drop those seats down and then, use that extra space, which is what I did when I dropped off my wife and her best friend at the airport last week for a little trip they're taking. It's well equipped. It still has, the same basic infotainment system that Nissan's had for many, many years, which, is fine. It works okay. Nothing special. It does have Android Auto and Apple CarPlay wireless support. The Platinum does have a little more upscale interior than some of the other trim levels of the Pathfinder. Not quite up to the level of the QX60, which is fine. Based on kind of where it is in the lineup. You don't want it really overlapping the Infiniti, because then otherwise, why would you buy an Infiniti? 284 horsepower, 259 pounds-feet of torque from the 3.5-liter V6, 9-speed automatic, intelligent all-wheel drive. There's a mode selector for drive and terrain modes. It can tow up to 6,000 pounds. in at least in theory, when properly equipped. It's got the ProPilot Assist lane centering system, which we, I don't know if we really delved into that when we had Kelly Funkhauser on the other week, but that one ranked up pretty well. I think it was like number 4 overall in their rankings. It's a pretty decent system.
I like that one too. I think it's good.
And 12-inch instrument cluster display and a 9-inch center touchscreen. All in, this one came to $54,785, including delivery. You want to guess on the delivery charge?
$9.95.
What'd you say, Robbie?
I'm going to say $1.
Nicole wins it. It's $12.95.
I knew it was going to be more, but I just wanted to say $1.
So, you know, it's interesting.
In my heart, I knew it was more, but I just wanted to say $1.
Sure, whatever you need to say to make your excuses, that's fine.
In my heart.
This one and the Telluride, you know, very similar vehicles, you know, in terms of, you know, the market they're going after. And they're priced within $300 of each other. So, you know, it's, you know, and a lot of these more premium trim level, three-row upper mid-size crossovers, you know, are all getting into that lower to mid $50,000 price range now. So it's really, you know, and they're all pretty good. So you kind of have to look at it and say, which one, you know, which one's design, you know, Palisade or Pathfinder or Telluride or Explorer, you know, which one's design appeals to me? Because they all have, you know, or Highlander, you know, they all have pretty similar features and characteristics to them. So it's, you know, what do you like the look of? And, you know, which one's actually available on a dealer's lot or to order? The Pathfinder Platinum four-wheel drive, it's a pretty decent SUV. It's rated at 22 miles per gallon combined, 20 city, 25 highway. I think I averaged about 20 overall. With it. It was kind of cold when I had it. So it's not bad at all.
Thumbs up. You like it. Would drive again.
Yeah, it was okay. Fine. All right. Let's see. Let's delve into some of the stories of this week. The F-150 Lightning has been getting a lot of positive reviews over the past year since it came out.
It has.
Now they've had probably their biggest issue to date. They have had to do a stop sale on stop delivery and shipment on the F-150 Lightning because they've got an issue with battery packs. I spoke with someone from Ford the other day. They weren't able to share much or really almost any detail at this point. But they did tell me that the fire that occurred actually occurred in the factory before it was shipped. It's not clear if it was in the factory or in the lot, but somewhere, you know, before it left the factory and was shipped to a dealer, they had a fire, a battery fire in one of these. And so they're investigating it. They think they have a fix for it. Right now they've got to stop. They've stopped production for at least 2 weeks. But hopefully they'll have a fix soon. Ford wouldn't tell me if the problem was with the battery pack, assembly or whether it was a problem with the cells, you know, which is the problem that we had with previous battery fires from GM and Hyundai and BMW. Those were problems with the cell manufacturing. It's not clear exactly where the issue is on this one. But hopefully we'll find out soon.
Yeah, that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of Ford's top selling, it's one of the top selling EVs that's not a Tesla, you know, and there's a big backlog for them. So Ford right now is still making changes. They're working on, there's a lot of construction going on at the factory in Dearborn where they build these to ramp up the production rate to 150,000 annually by this fall. And so hopefully it doesn't take them too long to sort out whatever the problem was and find a permanent fix.
Yeah. I bet they'll find something quick. This isn't exactly a vehicle that they can afford to just have sitting around chilling. You know, yeah. They need to get this one. A lot of people want this one. Got to get it moving, boys. Figure it out.
Yep.
The fact well, especially, that they're going up to 150,000 units a year is pretty mm-hmm. insane. Because
yeah.
not a lot of cars sell 150,000 units. I mean, the top 10, but then after that, it falls off dramatically.
Yeah. And, you know, Chevrolet is supposed to start delivering Silverado EVs, at least the work truck, sometime this spring. And then consumer trucks later in the year, followed by the GMC Sierra. And someday, who knows, there might even be a Cybertruck, but I wouldn't hold my breath on that one.
Someday. It's gonna. I really think the Cybertruck's just going to be this little niche product. They sell like maybe 10,000 a year.
Yeah.
Because they're essentially going to have to be hand-built. It's the whole like idea. Either you back away and say, you know what, we made a mistake, or you just stick with it, and you have to charge an enormous amount for them. Because it's just building them is going to be.
Long suffering sigh.
Well, speaking of Tesla, this week they announced a recall on 363,000. Tesla vehicles with the full self-driving beta software in there. And, you know, for issues like this, you know, the legally, you know, the terminology is still recall, even though customers won't actually have to take the vehicles into a service center to be repaired. They're going to do an OTA software update. But, you know, from NHTSA's investigations, they found a number of issues that they went back to Tesla with and said, hey, you know, we want these things fixed. Let's see, that includes things like driving too fast, rolling through traffic signals, traveling or turning through certain intersections during a stale yellow traffic light, the perceived duration.
Wait, what's a stale yellow traffic light? What does that even mean?
I'm not 100% sure.
I'm Googling just because I've never heard that before. Okay, continue. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. Let's see. The perceived duration of the vehicle's static position at certain intersections with a stop sign. So, whether it's actually coming to a full stop or how long it's staying stationary before it moves again. So basically,
I know what a stale yellow is. I have a definition. If you didn't enter the intersection until the light was about to or had already turned yellow, you had a stale yellow and are guilty of running a yellow light. So,
okay. It's like when you take a left turn, like you're supposed to be out there and waiting and waiting and waiting. It turns yellow, then you can turn still. But if you're still back behind, let's say the crosswalk, yellow and you go for it.
Yes. If it's yellow, you go for it. Yeah. Okay. Which is actually, I knew that. I just didn't know that was what that was called.
So technically that's illegal pretty much everywhere. Also, what else? Adjusting vehicle speed while traveling through certain variable speed zones. So, you know, if the speed limit changes as you're driving down the road, the car wasn't properly adjusting the vehicle speed to the new speed limits. Negotiating a lane change out of certain turn-only lanes to continue traveling straight. So this one is, you know, potentially a particularly dangerous one. You know, so if the car was in a turn lane, in a left turn lane, and then decided, no, I'm going to go straight and changes lanes, you know, over to one of the through lanes, they don't want it doing that either. So Tesla is going to have to make some software updates for this. It's not clear exactly what they're going to change or even when they're going to release this updated software, but they did agree to do these changes based on what NHTSA said. So we'll see when that happens, you know, if it hopefully gets any better. Frankly, I think NHTSA didn't go far enough. I think they should have just told them to stop. Just recall FSD beta entirely because it's just not safe enough. It's not something that should be in the hands of consumers yet.
Autopilot is the one of all the driver's assistance systems that I've driven over the years. It's the one where when something goes hinky, it really goes. It's like it's all.
That is a technical term, by the way.
Its technical term is hinky. Yeah. Yes.
Wait, it's something. It is. Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, it's a little like everything else. You're like, all right, this is a little weird. I've had cars stop in the middle of the freeway. It does like real. It's very extreme. There's an extreme reaction.
That's what happened at Thanksgiving on the Bay Bridge. A Tesla in I think it was actually in FSD mode, get pulled over to the leftmost lane in the tunnel going through the across Treasure Island, and then slammed on the brakes. And then seven other cars right behind it all slammed into it.
Oh, I had a Model 3 do the exact same thing in the exact same spot, but going the other direction. Oh. I'm trying to think. Is it above, below, below? Well, no, they're yeah, below.
Are the tunnels side by side or because the bridge they're is stacked?
They're stacked. Well, the bridge is stacked on the San Francisco side. On the Bay, on the East Bay side, it's separated. They're next to each other. They changed it when they had to replace the old bridge.
Right.
But as you come to the tunnels, the tunnels are stacked.
Okay. All right. So anyway, Tesla is going to have to do an update on those vehicles in the not too distant future. Fortunately, you know, the good thing about OTA updates is, like, unlike in the past when an automaker had to do a software update to fix a compliance problem, a legal compliance problem, they had to convince all the customers to come in and actually get the cars updated.
Often
took months or years. And the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration actually has some regulations, but when there's a recall, a safety recall, a certain percentage, I think it's 75% of the vehicles have to be, the repairs or the changes have to be completed within 2 years. And back in the early 2010s, there was something that Stellantis or Fiat Chrysler at the time had on Ram pickups. There was a recall on Ram pickups, and they didn't get all of them done within that time period, and then they had to pay extra fines.
Oh, wow.
With OTA updates, you know, the manufacturer can just push out those updates and basically have everybody updated the same day. So that's one of the upsides, along with the convenience factor of not having to go to a dealer or, you know, service.
Yeah, because that can be a pain.
That's the best part.
Because sometimes you're like, you have to drop it off at 7 a.m. and then we'll have it done at 5. And then you call it 4:30. You're like, yeah, it's not done. Do you want your car back? I'm like, yes, I want my car back, but you got to bring it back tomorrow. I'm like,
that was always the way. It's never ready. That's always me. Oh, you have it? We'll have it back to you first, you know, by the end of the day if you have it here the night before.
We'll give you a call.
It's like, it's 4:59. Am I getting my car?
All right. So we've been very positive on Hyundai and Kia vehicles and Genesis vehicles here on Wheel Bearings over the years. And they make some really great products. They're great value. You get a lot for your money, and they drive really well, and they're generally pretty reliable. But
they're super easy to drive, especially when you want to steal one.
Yeah,
if you just would like to take
even
one
without a key. I can't remember. Have we talked about the fact that these cars are getting stolen?
Yeah, we have talked about it. That it was a big deal. Yeah.
Okay. So they Hyundai and Kia for reasons, you know, probably having to do with saving a couple of bucks, have decided that on their low-end entry level models that still have a key, a physical key instead of a fob, a push button, they were not going to include a chip in the key to act as an immobilizer or to disable the immobilizer on those vehicles. And some enterprising car thieves found that out, and somebody decided, hey, let's do a viral TikTok video about this. And then after that happened, people started stealing these things in large numbers. So initially, Kia said, okay, we'll give everybody a free club to put on your steering wheel.
Did they really? I didn't know that. Did they?
Kia would give you a club, but Hyundai wanted you to pay, like, money to fix it.
$170 really? For an immobilizer kit. Plus, you know, whatever the installation cost was, which was hundred dollars more than that. Now, this past week, they announced that they are going to fix the problem for free with a software update. They figured out a way to fix it in software to basically enable an immobilizer system and also make some changes to the anti-theft alarm to keep it on longer if somebody does manage to try and steal it.
Yeah.
Hopefully, in the not too distant future, if you have one of these lower end Kia or Hyundai products, you'll be able to get that fix free of charge at your local dealer.
Because in the 90s, if this was an issue, like some people would find out, and maybe there'd be like a, you know, maybe there was an urban myth that you could do this thing with Kias that would sort of.
And no one would really know if you could do it or not.
By the time it got to you, like, it would be wrong. But now you're like, well, we're just going to put on TikTok. The Kia boy is going to put on TikTok. And right. Then everyone's like, oh, this is easy.
In two seconds, it's like free cars for everyone.
Next thing you know, tens of thousands of cars are being stolen.
Yeah, I'm a 16-year-old with nothing to lose.
Why the heck not? I could use a car.
All right. Last topic before we answer a couple of questions is EV charging ports. BMW blog had a post up about this, complaining about where, you know, well, every manufacturer puts them in different places. The Kia Niro, for example, has its charging port in the middle of the front fascia, as does the Nissan Leaf, whereas the Kia EV6 and the Ioniq 5 have it on the right rear corner. Tesla has theirs in the left rear corner, in part of the tail lamp cluster. You know, some have it on the right front fender, some have it on the left front fender. Where do you think that charging ports should go?
I think it should go on the front.
In the front, because I wrote a whole article about this like a year and a half ago about how we should stop putting charging ports on the back, because most charging stations are front. You know, you pull into it. And now you have like, oh, hold on, let me back into this charging port. And sometimes it's in a parking lot where it has the angled
charge.
So now you have to drive the wrong way down the lane.
I'm 100%.
To get it back in. And it's like when I get stuck behind, when you're driving through, it's always the guys in the big truck. For some reason, they love backing their trucks in the spaces. So you're like, you're going in. They could have just pulled in 2 seconds, but now I got to wait 2 minutes while they back their F-150 into the spot. And now we're doing that with EVs.
I just did, like, when I did the road trip in the EV6, it's a pain in the butt, because depending on exactly how the charging, like the parking space and the little protective like pillars they have so you don't back into anything, and the way the curb is, every now and then it's like you have a curb that's very close. They wedged you in the corner of a parking lot, so you have no real clearance, so you're backing in. It's like, just let me pull in and plug in my car and I can back out where there's not like stuff you're trying to line up for. Just pull in. I think it should be on the front.
On the front.
Is that on the front or on the corner?
Well,
not
front,
on the
front,
corner. Because the
I'm
corner
fine
is
with the front corner, but I'm still, I want it in the front. I don't want the rear corner.
I guess the front, but I want it on the front. I would love it right smack in the middle. Because then no matter which side you're pulling into, it's easy to get
to. Yeah, you
don't
have to like fight with it.
Sometimes you're manhandling that, because the cables.
They're super thick.
They're very, very thick. It's not like the cable on a hose for your gas. And if it's cold, they actually are difficult.
They do get pretty stiff.
Then you're trying to sort of like bend it to get the connector to line up just right.
You have to use two hands. You're like,
There was one where it was cold and the way the connector was.
Like you're loading a torpedo in a submarine.
It took both me and Eileen to get it to the stupid thing to plug in, because it had been, the way it was hanging on the thing, the cord had sort of kinked funny. So it was sort of half frozen-ish that way. So we're trying, it's like, she's literally bending the middle of the hose. I'm trying to twist the connector. I'm like, dear God, just line up. I just want it, in the front, right in the middle, so you can get this no matter how the hose is and no matter where you are. Strong feelings.
Well, except that that's great if the charger is located at the end of the space. Like, you know, the way most superchargers are. There's a few that aren't this way, but most of them, you know, they have them lined up along a curb, you know, and you pull up, you know, or back in, you know, right next to the charger. But, you know, a lot of the charging stations, you know, some of them are like that, mm-hmm. Where, you know, you can pull straight in and the charger is right there in front of you and you plug it in, no problem. But others, and there's, you know, a couple of charge point DC chargers near me here that are set up that way. But the EA station over here is set up with pairs of chargers, you know, with parking spaces in between them. So they're on the side of the car.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's all over. And I've seen other EA stations where they are set up, you know, along the end. So Yeah, even the charging stations aren't consistent.
Well, they are totally inconsistent. So one charging station's easy to pull in, another one's not. There's all this inconsistency because we're still figuring it out. So I think we should figure it out. So it's always in the front, and every charging station, like, you don't pull into a gas station and go like, wonder where the nozzle's going to be on this one. Like, you always pull up to the side.
Yeah,
your gas tank is always on the side.
But if you're like us driving different cars every week, you got to remember.
But still, you know it's going to be on the side of your car. Like, you're going to pull up, you look and see, am I left or right? Okay. You pull up and you pull up and the nozzle's on the side and your car's going to line up with it on the side and everything's going to be happy with. It's not the same with electric vehicles.
Okay,
like,
what,
I want it to just pull straight in.
So what happens in the scenario, you know, and we're starting to get also some charging stations that are set up. They're set up with drive, you know, pull through for charging. So if you're towing a trailer, you know, so it's set up more like a traditional gas station.
Well, you can still pull up in the front with the pull through. That's the thing. You can still just stop there.
That's not going to negate you from using that.
Especially if it's right in front. So no matter what side you pull up in the pull through, if it's in the front, it's still going to go over there.
Yeah, it still works. I mean, if they wanted to set them up so they were giant like gas stations, you just pull in and they were all in your gas tank because your gas tank is always on the side. So it's always going to work with a side thing, you know, but I think putting them in the front.
Most charging is it's something you do while you're doing something else. And so you're parking as opposed to just pulling through really quickly.
If they start making charging stations that are like gas stations, then it would work just putting it on the side, just like it does a gas station.
If even it's in the front, it's fine because in the 70s, we had a Javelin challenge. You pull the license plate down in the truck.
It was under the license plate.
It was middle of the back.
Right?
Middle of the
back. It worked.
Middle of the front still works. We've solved the problem.
Done. Okay. Listen to us. There you go. There's
middle front. That's how we have it on our Kona, middle and front.
Yep, that's what I want. I agree with you. Middle front.
But a little tidbit. If you're renting a car, if you look at the actual gas station, the little gas logo in your car where the fuel station is, there's a little arrow. Yeah, where the gauge is, there's a little arrow that tells you which side your fueling port is. On EVs, it doesn't have that.
I was just thinking that as we were talking. I'm like, why don't they have that?
They should have they don't have that. I don't know. Understand why.
They should have that little charger icon there with an arrow pointing to
left or right or forward.
Maybe more of an overhead view icon of the car with an arrow pointing to where the charger is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would know, like, charger here or charger here, so you could see where
I think there's
it is.
One car I got in that doesn't have it, but that was – I should have remembered now. I feel bad because there's probably one person who has it, and they're like, hey.
They're like, we did that, and you didn't give us credit.
Most of them do not have it because I always check, and I'm always like –
thing that they didn't think to do that. Like, it's it's such a cool little thing in a gas vehicle. Why, when they were designing EVs, like, they're on their own, forget it, they can figure it out.
Well, you know, one of the advantages, you know, almost all of these EVs have digital instrument clusters, so they could easily, you know, update the iconography on the cluster
to put a little arrow update. It shouldn't be an arrow. It should be a lightning bolt that blinks.
A little
blink, blink.
There you go.
Like a little Shazam.
Yeah, like a little Shazam. Back right corner, Shazam. Front right corner.
Pew, pew, pew. That's
I also wanted to say Shazam or pew, pew. That would also work.
Okay. All right. Let's answer a couple of listener questions. Andy C. In the Discord asked, what does the team think about free charging provided to new EVs? For early adopters, this was a great bonus for early adopters getting an EV. However, this has recently caused significant overcrowding at EV chargers and led to bad habits. Example, not moving a vehicle when done charging or charging the battery to 100%.
So I've thought about this. I think that you get X amount, like we get 250 kilowatt hours of free charging with our Kona, which we've used like 10 so far. But I think it has to be a time limit as opposed to like you get this many, this much. I think you're like, oh, you get 30 minutes. Like BMW has like you get 30 minutes of free charging when you go to an EA station up to a certain amount. I think that'll help. When you just have like, oh, you have 250 kilowatts like I have, I could just go and park the car there and charge to 100% every time if I'm bored and go to like the IHOP that's nearby.
At least six times anyway.
Yeah, at least six times. But if you have a 30-minute time limit, or like, okay, it's 30 minutes, and then after that, you're paying. I think the 30-minute time limit will help alleviate some of this sort of like people just parking and leaving their cars there for the free charging.
Do they not Do they not? There is an idle charge.
You get charged for idle.
I was going to say, I was wondering, does it not give you an idle charge if you have so you'd still pay for the idle charge?
Pretty much everybody does that now. Yeah.
I didn't know. The way you were saying it's like, wait, you're still paying extra if you're sitting there not really charging.
Yeah, for the idle charge. In most cases, I think EA is like a 10 minute grace period. And after that, they start charging you an idle fee for sitting there. And to what you said, Robbie, you know, I think the way that Kia does it on the EV6, for example, you get unlimited 30-minute charging sessions on Electrify America. So you can charge as many times as you want, but each session is limited to 30 minutes. And after that, it shuts off. And, you know, given that, you know, in most cases, you know,
How fast that thing charges.
Assuming the charger is actually functioning, given that it's Electrify America, is, you know, not necessarily something you want to count on. But assuming it's functioning as intended, you know, you should be able to get pretty much a full charge in 30 minutes or very close to it. And then after that, you know, you have a few minutes of grace period, and then you've got to unplug it and move it. And preferably do move it. Don't just unplug it and leave it there. You're the worst person
if you do that.
You're just a bad person. EV drivers that park in front of a charger because it's right next to the store that they're going to.
And don't actually plug in.
That's bad.
I've seen a couple Teslas. A couple Teslas do that. And I'm like, come on.
You know what I was seeing, and I didn't. I was trying to decide if this would make me mad if I was driving an EV every day, and you drive one, Robbie. So does this make you mad? When people, there were people railing on a thread I was reading on Twitter about those who charge their vehicle to over 80%. They're very, very, very mad that people would sit and like charge to 85 or 90. Because, you know, you got that sweet spot, 10 to 80. And then once you hit past 80, if you're trying to get to 100, you're going to take a lot longer. And people are really angry. But in my head, I'm like, well, that'd be inconvenient. But like, what if you're trying to go somewhere? Like, yeah, what if you need the extra charge, you know?
I look at it as... Like, I had to charge that EV6 GT that I had to 100% because I was doing a drive. And it was part of it was, you know, with, this is where I started. This is where I'm going. And so I wanted to charge it up to 100%. But when I do that, I make sure that there's other charging ports. And so if
so you don't go and take the last available charging port.
I always check it. Like, usually it's like, you know, there's eight 350 charging ports in Novato, on the other side of the bridge. So I look and I'm like, oh, there's five of them are available on my way over there. I'm like, okay, because that's where I want to start my drive. Yeah. So when I got there, there were still five of them available. And then by the time I left, there were still three available. So I felt, I didn't feel like, you know, it does feel weird, like you're charging up to 100%. But if you're going somewhere, I feel like if you're going on a road trip,
you want
to. If you're road tripping, you probably want to just go up to 80 and then get back on the road.
Unless, like, but like, I see, but people were mad. I think the anger surprised me. Like, how
just dare was on Twitter
charged. Yeah,
just, and it was Twitter person, is mad. Twitter was, is just
they
mad.
Were angry, what? And it wasn't like one guy was angry. Was like, yeah, those a-holes, you charge up to 100%. I'm like, but what if you're driving and you need?
Yeah,
you
they need don't that understand the situation
for some reason. What if you?
There are some people who are just like, this is how I charge my car all the time, and I'm just going to charge to 100%, and I'm just going to sit there. I'm going to put my bolt on the 350, even though there's a 150 next to it. Like, that's when you're like,
people are very angry.
And so someone came up and they were talking because one of the chargers was charging very slowly at the EA station. And they're like, well, you're charging up to this. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm like, I explained. I review cars. I'm going on a drive. Because everyone kind of gets out at some point and just starts talking to each other.
Right. You're talking to random people. Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm doing a big drive, a big test today with the car. And they're like, oh, okay. And it was very much like, this guy's going up to 100%. I could tell that was the conversation I got out. And I talked to them. And they're like, oh, okay. And then I'm like, do you guys want to sit in the car? And they're like, ooh, they get all excited about that. Because it's the EV6 GT. So they were just like, oh, right. How fast does it go? I'm like, too fast. It's great.
Very fast. Speed quick. Yeah.
All right. Adam J. on Mastodon asked, a while ago I sent a question asking how to submit feedback to a manufacturer as there wasn't any consistent way to report bugs or request features. Wanted to share that Ford has done something pretty cool in my Mach-E with the latest OTA update. Huh. There's now a voice feedback option where you can record up to 45 seconds of any comment you want. Us owners in the forums have been coordinating to send in similar items for common bugs and requests.
Ooh,
pretty cool.
That's smart. That's
really, yeah. If
that's
you're
great
all
of
the
Ford,
same,
And that's great when you guys all, when you, the whole, when the community all knows, okay, this is something that we all think is an issue.
We all hate this. So you can tell Ford we all hate this so they know it's not just one guy in Idaho. It's everybody.
That's pretty sweet. Good
that's,
job.
Yeah, that's really
a good
neat.
Idea.
Good job on, good job on Ford. Good job on Adam J's forum
group.
People.
And, yeah,
and
really
considering
cool.
that, you know, all of these EVs are connected, you know, there's no reason why everybody shouldn't be doing this. So, you know, the rest of the industry, take note. You know, and pay attention and do this.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, JB says, sorry, I have nothing on those. Nothing on those as I've moved from an. Oh, so this was in response to the comment he had asked about what we were driving. You know, to see if he had see if there were any questions that we had. And I had put in that I was driving the Pathfinder, and we had the QX60 and Q50. So there's nothing of those that moved on to, from the SUV to a wagon.
Yeah.
But I do like the looks of the new Pathfinder. I do, however, have a sort of odd topic to consider. Generalizations made about drivers based upon what they drive. I know one should never put much faith in such things, but nonetheless, they do get shared online. Historically, BMW drivers have been an example of an inconsiderate and likely not to use their signals. More recently, I've seen Reddit posts on how Nissan Altima drivers are very dangerous.
Really?
That's...
Huh. I guess, okay.
I mean, a lot of... I know a lot of ride-hail drivers use Altimas because they've been able to get very good deals on those.
Oh, that's the...
So maybe that's it. So, he's seen a few examples in Southeast Michigan and New Jersey. But again, is this really a thing? Discuss amongst yourselves.
So I don't know, Altima drivers. I always feel like my thing is Prius drivers who are slow as snails.
So I think riding a motorcycle or riding a scooter around, you start recognizing, drivers. And I think the folks that were the most terrifying for me were white F-150 pickup trucks driven by contractors, because they give zero F's about what's going on. They're just like, I got to do this job. They're just driving around. Sometimes they're probably not even driving their own truck. They just don't care. They park wherever they want. And that was surpassed by ride hail, by Uber and Lyft drivers, because there a lot of them, especially in the Bay Area, aren't from the Bay Area. They come here because they can make more money.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know where they're going. They have someone in the car. They're trying to figure out where that person is. They're not really paying attention. They're looking at the app. They also have another phone. Then they also have their navigation. They have three screens that they're looking at.
And half the time they're talking to somebody on a fourth phone.
Yeah, they're talking to someone on the phone. They're trying to figure out where to pick this person up or drop this person off. And they're just driving all over the place. So those are really the most terrifying people on the road. If it's outside of them, older gentlemen and German sedans and young dudes and tricked out cars were typically the ones that I had to be careful of.
Young dudes and tricked out cars are notoriously, well, they're young dudes.
They're young
tricked
dudes.
Tricked out cars. I think that says the whole thing.
I did have somebody in a young dude in a BMW chase me once because he's because
what did you
I
do to
him,
engender
because
being
I passed
what?
Him on my Vespa. And he was just angry. So then he threw a bottle at me.
Oh,
and
my
so
God.
I chased him and I called the cops on him.
Because he threw a pen at me once. We were in heavy traffic. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. We were in heavy traffic. It was years ago. And you know that heavy traffic and like you've got to merge in, like you're getting on the highway. Somebody, you have to merge in front of somebody, like, you know, when it's bumper to bumper traffic. And I was, you know, we're nicely zipping and I merged in front of the guy, but then the guy was like honked at me. And I'm like, literally, it was like, you go, I go, you go, I go. It was, and he was like very angry. Like somehow I cut him off. I'm like, dude, we're going 1 mile an hour. Everyone's just merging. There was
it's a zipper.
Like a zipper. I don't even know what he was mad about. And then eventually he gets into the lane next to me and he waits until he can get right next to me and pulls next to me and he's yelling at me and he threw a pen at my car. I was like, because I'm looking at him like, what? He threw a pen at me.
So you know how hard it is to find a pen sometimes, especially in your car when you need it?
I know. I'm like, dude, you're going to regret throwing that pen at me in your weird, weird road rage because I dared zipper in front of you as I got on the highway.
Unless he has a box of pens always ready. Like
he's ready to whip a pen at a person.
A box of Bic ballpoints.
I just feel like he was so mad. I'm like, the only thing you could find in your car was a pen?
He's like looking around. He's like, what do I got?
I'm not getting rid of my coffee. I'll throw this pen at her. Yeah.
I got rid of all the grenades I usually throw. Right. So
I guess it could have been worse, but it's just such a weird thing.
No more coins.
It must have been like 20 years ago. I'm like, that man just threw a pen at me. Okay. Yeah. That, for merging.
That is definitely an odd one.
It was odd.
In the Discord, Andy C. Responded to this one and said, the new BMW stereotype drivers in the San Francisco Bay Area are Tesla drivers.
Yeah. Oh, are they really?
Yeah. I think is, that's correct.
Yeah.
No, that is.
I mean, I know a number of Tesla drivers who you know don't drive like that, but yeah, I've definitely seen plenty to do.
When I drive a BMW, I make sure I am the nicest person. I'm a really nice person on the road because we drive so much. I don't get angry and people cut me off. I just like whatever. I'm just like because yeah. I still have to do my job and I still have to go where I'm going. I mean, it's not worth the emotional baggage of getting angry every time someone does something stupid just because people are all doing something stupid. But yeah, I see the Tesla drivers are, and I always wonder, and I kind of pull up next to them to wonder, I'm like, do they have FSD on? Do they have, is it them or the car?
Why they're being such terrible drivers?
You or the car? Is it you or is it software? Like who's creating the situation right now?
Well, my friend Henry Payne on his Tesla with FSD, he got a student driver sticker and put it on the back there.
Did he really?
Yeah. After the first couple of days, it was so bad, he just put a student driver sticker on.
The student driver.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's not all that inaccurate.
Right. It's just not the human that's the student. It's the software, details.
Which is terrifying. But no, there's lots of really great drivers. It's just that you see that one person who does that one thing. It's like when people are like, you know, if you ride bikes, you're like, everyone is trying to kill you. I'm like, well, it's more terrifying when you're on a bike because one just sort of angry person can actually kill you versus the person, like when people who are driving cars are like, this one time this bike rider like didn't stop at a stop sign. I'm like, yeah, but that didn't like put your life in peril. But they base everything upon that one bicycle rider. So it's yeah.
Well, you know, and another one of the classic stereotypes, of course, is the Miata, you know, which has long been referred to by many as a hairdresser's car.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, there was a whole Top Gear thing about fast, it. And you're just like, it's tired. It's a lazy homophobic trope, is what it is. Yeah, it's a lazy homophobic trope.
Yeah, they're just wrong. So, all right, well, that's it for this week. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
See ya.
Bye-bye.